Chapter 1. Why we need to talk about money. The responsibilities we never faced at their age and the power of real conversations. In the middle of 2011, in the space of a single week, I heard from two different parents struggling with uncomfortable questions about money. A national conversation about inequality, about who had money and how much and why, was beginning. A presidential campaign the following year was going to turn, in part, on who could best represent all of America. Nobody knew how large and loud the conversation was going to be, but a bunch of curious middle and high school kids were making inquiries as they read the news and connected it to strains in their own communities. Are we rich? Who do we know who is rich? Why did you choose your job when you could have chosen something else that would have let us have a nicer home or go on better vacations? Their parents didn't know how to respond, and I knew right away why they had come to me for answers. Schools aren't good at dealing with questions like these. If teachers answer them by talking about government and taxes and policy, the responses can start to sound political and boring. But if they respond by addressing individual behavior and ambition, then the answers start to seem like moral judgments. No matter how it comes up in the classroom, kids then come home and start sensitive conversations, and the administrators' phones start ringing the next morning with parental complaints. At private schools, where there is more freedom in the curriculum, talking about money and social class is particularly complex. There, most families feel lucky to have enough money to send their kids to the school or receive financial aid to attend, but parents and administrators get flustered if anyone brings up the topic of affluence and its effect on children. Big questions, strong feelings. Journalists, though, all of us love uncomfortable questions. And starting the year before I heard from the two parents, I'd been collecting the gnarliest ones that kids of all ages were asking about money. Each time I heard a good one, I'd put it up on the New York Times website. Why is that person asking us for money at the red light? Shouldn't we give our second home to somebody who doesn't have one? Why don't we have a second home? Do you make less money than Daddy? Are we poor? Are people without nice clothes lazy? Will we run out of money now that you have no job? I suggested an answer for each one. Readers pitched in with improvements, and everyone found it plenty useful. My own daughter, who is now 9 years old, was asking some of these questions herself, so I was testing the answers at home as I wrote. The two parents who had contacted me, they'd been following these conversations online, and they had a challenge for me disguised as an invitation. Would I come speak to two groups of parents at their children's schools and give them ideas about how to talk to their kids about money? And could I please keep in mind that some of the families with more money than average were starting to feel demonized, and those with less were feeling like their noses were being rubbed in everyone else's affluence? It would help, they added, if I could discuss the issues in a way that would not leave everyone in the room feeling resentful or inadequate. Instantly, I said yes. There aren't that many fundamentally new challenges in the worlds of parenting or money, but this felt like one of them, and it was new for a couple of reasons. In the past few decades, scholars have piled into a field that has come to be known as behavioral economics. If you've read any of the Freakonomics books, you know what this is about. Human quirks and emotions have a profound impact on economic decisions, from governments right on down to individuals. A ton of feelings are tied up in the decisions we make about our money and the amount we earn or have at any given moment. On one hand, there's often pride and joy and excitement about the things that we're able to afford. But sometimes doubt and shame and embarrassment and envy creep in. Most people who read their credit or debit card statements carefully each month have felt many of these feelings at least once. And as I've discovered in my decade of writing about money for the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times, learning to recognize and control these emotions is the most important factor in picking the right mutual fund and shopping for a mortgage. It's feelings, after all, that drive bad behavior and lousy decision-making.